Hello, I'm Sue Carter, sitting in for the vacationing Mark Bayshore. Apparently well-deserved, at least certainly if you ask Mark. I'm taking a little time out from the School of Journalism here at Michigan State to spend the time with you. It's always a pleasure to be able to share the current state microphone. For nearly one in four American women who have experienced domestic violence, escaping an abusive relationship is no easy feat. Victims often face economic and psychological pressure to stay with their abusive partner. Even when they seek out help, these men and women can still be at risk, sometimes fatal violence. An average of three women are murdered by intimate partners every day in the United States. A recent report from the Violence Policy Center found that Michigan ranks in the top 10 states for the number of these domestic homicides. And here to talk to us about how our state ended up on this list is April Zioli, Associate Professor in the Michigan State University School of Criminal Justice. Dr. Zioli, welcome. Good to have you here with us.
Good to be here.
Can we start with some numbers first off? What do we know about how common domestic violence and homicides related to domestic violence are in Michigan?
Well, we know, as you mentioned, that one in four women, some studies suggest that one in three women above the age of 18 will be victims of domestic violence within their lifetimes. So that is, you know, a very high rate of intimate partner violence. We don't really know the percentage of those cases that end up as, you know, domestic violence homicides. But domestic violence homicide is rare, happily. In Michigan, in 2013, the year the Violence Policy Center study you cited looked at, 73 women were victims of homicide. And those victims were mostly victims of intimate partner homicide, so killed by a spouse, ex-spouse, boyfriend, common-law spouse, someone they lived with.
Those are the ones that we see profiled often. They make the news, they make the headlines. But proportionally, fortunately, as you point out, of the many women who are exposed to domestic violence, the number of homicides is pretty small. The question that people who have never been around or experienced domestic violence have, the question is, why don't the women leave?
Well, they do. Actually, you know, many of these women leave many times. There are many barriers to leaving. There can be financial barriers, as you mentioned, particularly if you have children. If you don't have an income to fall back on, if you don't have a place that you can take them, leaving is not going to be as potentially good an option for you. Many women are driven into homelessness when they leave their intimate partners, and they take their children with them to the homeless shelter. So financial barriers are part of it. They may also not get support from their friends or family, religious community, community at large to leave. So leaving can be very difficult, but with resources like MSU Safe Place, like EVE, like the domestic violence shelters and resources across Michigan, leaving is a little bit easier. They can help make the transition for women. They can lead women to legal and financial resources and help women to get out.
Leaving can be a safe time, but it also can be a time marked with a high level of risk and danger.
It can.
What's the correlation? What is the causation there even?
Well, the most dangerous time for women, the time that they are most likely to be killed, is that first 3 months around leaving. And separation is one of the leading risk factors for intimate partner homicide. The thought is that intimate partner homicide is about power and control. It is the abusive partner trying to dominate the victim. And when the victim says, I'm leaving, I'm getting out of here, I'm taking the kids, that is a very real challenge to the perpetrator's power and control over her. So he might retaliate with even greater violence, which is why we think we see homicides. He may also try to put other pressures on her to get her back. We know that when women have children and they go through custody cases with the partners that they share children with, the abusive partners that they share children with, the abusive partner can use access to the children, gaining access to the children legally to continue the abuse of the children or to draw the woman back into the relationship, you know, if he is the one who gets custody of the children.
Dr. Zioli, who's in Michigan State's School of Criminal Justice, you mentioned power and control. And that reminds me of a law school class I had on family law where the discussion was the power and control wheel or cycle.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Now, when a lot of people think of intimate partner violence or domestic violence, they think of physical assaults. And, you know, that is what we talk about. If he ever hit me, I would leave. Why, you know, he hits her, she should leave. But it isn't just about physical assaults. And in fact, physical assaults might make up a small proportion of abusive tactics that perpetrators use. Domestic violence is a system. It is a pattern of abusive tactics used by a perpetrator. And some of those other abusive tactics are, you know, sexual assault, of course, psychological abuse, mm-hmm. economic abuse, intimidation, isolation. A perpetrator can isolate a victim from their family and friends so that when they want to leave, they have few people to turn to because they have been socially isolated. An abuser can prevent a woman from having a job so that she isn't bringing in her own financial resources. He can take her money from her if she does have a job. They also use pets, abuse pets in an effort to control women. They minimize their abuse. They say it isn't all that bad. You know, the point is that there is just this constellation of oppression, of abuse that women go through. And if we're just looking at physical assaults, we're not getting the whole picture. It's easy to ask the question, why does someone leave? When we're only thinking of those physical assaults, right? But if you're thinking of the fact that this person is being isolated, has few financial resources, has the children being used as a bargaining chip.
All of these elements fit in together as a pattern?
All of these elements fit in, and it becomes much harder. There are many more barriers to leaving.
It sounds like, in some regard, it's an invisible cell that the abused partner, typically a woman, very often a woman, is placed in. And are the things you mentioned, are those good signals for people on the outside, family members or friends, to be aware of and mm-hmm. and maybe interact with or understand that there might be some abuse going on?
Oh, yes. Yes. If you see your sister, brother, child in a situation where their partner is dominating them, humiliating them, being, you know, physically abusive to them, obviously, you do want to say something. You do want to say, you know, are things okay in this relationship? You know, what do you want out of this relationship? Mm-hmm. Are you being treated the way you want to be treated? What you don't want to do is come in judgmentally and say, this is obviously abusive. You need to leave right now. Because that may not be helpful. It may not be what the victim needs to hear at that moment. You know, what you need to do is provide victims of intimate partner violence with a listening ear and ask them what they need to make the situation better. Because many of these women know exactly what they need in order to be able to leave or in order to be able to gain safety. And if we ask them and help them, you know, gain those things, then they might be able to gain safety more quickly.
That might be the key to opening that invisible cell.
It really might be.
Right. It sounds like also it's not the kind of situation where a direct intervention is necessarily called for. I think of maybe someone who's steeped in alcoholism where an intervention is helpful.
Sure.
But this is a much more graded one, if that's a way of thinking about it.
Well, you definitely don't want to sit the victim down with, you know, five of their friends and say you need to get out now. Maybe that's called for if the situation is extremely dangerous. But what you want to do is provide resources and provide that non-judgmental ear that is really listening, you know, to hear what the victim wants and telling her there are resources that can help you.
Dr. April Zioli in the Michigan State University School of Criminal Justice, does your research look in any way at demographics? Are there particular women, demographically speaking, who are at greater risk than others?
For intimate partner violence?
Right.
Well, intimate partner violence does cut across racial and social classes, but it it really looks like women who are impoverished are more likely to experience intimate partner violence, at least are less likely to be able to gain safety without the help of community resources. You know, as far as intimate partner homicide goes, women of color are overrepresented as mm-hmm. victims of intimate partner homicide. Mm-hmm.
Does anything about the research you have done in the School of Criminal Justice or elsewhere give us a sense as to why Michigan is in the top 10 of the list with respect to intimate partner violence?
Sure. What I tend to focus on is policy. So what are policy solutions to these problems? And most intimate partner homicides are committed with firearms. So what I have been looking at is how the laws that we have regarding firearms in Michigan and across the United States might help women gain safety. And Michigan's legal landscape when it comes to keeping firearms from perpetrators of intimate partner violence, it's kind of mixed. We don't have any state laws that prohibit those convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence from firearm possession. Mm-hmm. There is a federal law in place, but having a state law could strengthen our response.
Do you think that would make a difference then?
We suspect.
Potentially.
You know, that would make a difference. And I'm actually in the midst of a research project looking at that very question right now. Now, one of the laws that we do know makes a difference is, or that research suggests make a difference, is laws prohibiting people under domestic violence restraining orders from having firearms. Those tend to reduce intimate partner homicides in states or cities where they're in place. And Michigan does have a law that prohibits those under permanent domestic violence restraining orders from firearm possession. However, the vast majority of restraining orders in Michigan are not permanent restraining orders. They are ex parte orders that were put in place without a hearing, mm-hmm. At which the offender could defend himself.
Yeah, ex parte means only one of the people is called to court and
exactly
and presents that evidence. So,
right.
So they're not permanent. They're not lasting. And sometimes, Dr. Zioli, people talk about a personal protection order as being nothing more than a piece of paper.
Right. The evidence is somewhat mixed on whether or not domestic violence restraining orders lead to safety. The evidence does suggest that women feel safer mm-hmm. and, are more confident when they have restraining orders. And that is no small thing. If we can help women emotionally and psychologically feel like they are in a better place and that they are more protected with these restraining orders. But it looks like there are some offenders who are otherwise law-abiding, if I can use that term, citizens who would obey the restraining order because they don't want greater sanctions. Mm-hmm. And some are simply not going to care about the domestic violence restraining order. And the trick is figuring out who is who. And research hasn't really been able to do that very well yet, but people are still working on that question.
And this is polyvalent. There are a lot of factors that fit into that. Just one final thought. You mentioned Safe Place. Mm-hmm. Haven House, I know, is in the Tri-County area. Mm-hmm. Some other resources that you can point to?
Names are escaping me. So Safe Place and Eve here in Ingham, mm-hmm. Havens in Oakland County.
Right.
I'm blanking on names right now, but
is there a good place to go?
Every county has.
Who in a county would be a good point person or a lead person?
Well, I would actually go to the Michigan Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Their website has a list of resources in every single county. And so that's the Michigan Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And they not only have resources, but they have, a lending library. There are a lot of resources on their website that people can avail themselves of.
So there is help and there is hope.
In every county.
Great. Thank you so much. We've been talking about domestic violence and domestic homicides in Michigan. Our guest has been Dr. April Zaroli, Associate Professor in the Michigan State University School of Criminal Justice and part of the Research Consortium on Gender-Based Violence. Dr. Zeile, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
MSU's Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum focuses on contemporary art of all kinds. This week brings the conclusion of the Art of Brewing series. Ooh. The arts of tea and beer preparation have been previously featured at Broad. And on this coming Friday at 6 o'clock in the evening, Strange Matter Coffee Company owner Karen Nader and staff will deliver a presentation on all things coffee. WKAR's Peter Wharf and Karen Nader got together over a couple of cups, not surprisingly, at Strange Matter Bar last week. Kara first commented on the cafe's subautonomically inspired name.
It's just kind of highlighting the fact that we take a very scientific approach to everything that we do here. And I think that science is science, no matter which part you're in, whether it's physics, whether it's, you know, coffee brewing. It's all a similar understanding of a very detailed process.
Those will be some of the ideas that you present at the Broad program, The Art of Brewing Coffee. Can you tell me more about what will be happening on the 25th?
A big part of what we're doing is just kind of highlighting the art of coffee, which is, in our opinion, basically taking the idea that it's the farmer, it's the roaster, it's the barista, and then highlighting the work of everyone along that chain and making sure that we can bring out the best of all of that work and really, like, showcase it. So discussing how we showcase that, how we pick our roasters, how those roasters pick their farmers, and then how we go about picking our brewing methods, and how we brew our coffee, too, obviously, is a huge part of that. So in addition to a short talk about those topics, we're also going to be having individual tables where our baristas are going to be brewing on different brewing devices and talking about those brewing devices, offering samples on those brewing devices. And the cool thing is in the shop, you know, people sit at the bar, they get to talk to us a lot and ask us questions, but sometimes we're super busy.
Right.
Frequently we're super busy and we don't get a chance to really engage with people as much as we want to. So this is a chance for us to really talk about each brewing device, offer samples, have customers compare things. In the shop we just brew on the Kalita Wave. It's efficient and really consistent and delicious, so we can produce drinks pretty quickly on it. But at the Broad, we're going to be doing a vac pot, which is also known as a siphon, Chemex samples, French press, the Kalita Wave, and possibly a few others.
Tell us what the Kalita Wave is.
The Kalita Wave is a relatively new brewing device. It's out of Japan, and it's a flat-bottom manual brewing device. So there are a lot of different manual brewing devices that people see around. A long time ago, people had, like, plastic Melita drippers that you can get at any store. It's kind of a similar idea. It can be glass, it can be metal, it can be ceramic, and it has a flat bottom with a few holes in it depending on its size. And every manual brewing device has kind of specific ridges inside that allow for, in the designer's opinion, a better drawdown, which means basically you're controlling the flow of water as you pour it and how it extracts the coffee.
What are the things that go into learning and training your staff on your espresso maker? It seems like there are so many elements involved.
It's pretty intense, yeah. Someone recently apologized to one of my employees that they were a barista and they weren't in school and they were just making coffee for a living. And it's like, this is pretty intense stuff. We take it very seriously here. This is a career for some of these people. Most of them are in school or actually already have degrees, but they choose to work here because it's super challenging. A lot of them have worked here for a year and haven't actually touched the espresso machine. So there's a lot involved in it. There's a lot of understanding about brewing.
Where's the art for you?
The art is in the understanding of the science behind it. It's a combination of, you know, art, ritual, memories. Everyone has those things, I think, associated with coffee drinkers. Like, it's a daily thing for people. And everyone has a different idea of what that is, but I think it starts everyone's day. You know?
When did that spark first ignite with you?
You know, I was probably drinking coffee before my parents really wanted me to. When I was like 5, my grandparents were giving me coffee in this cute little coffee mug, a lot of cream and sugar.
Right.
and I was like, oh, this is such a great thing. You know, it actually was in a cowboy mug, which was probably my favorite thing about it. And from there, I always drank coffee. My parents let me drink it. They always warned me it would stunt my growth, and it didn't. So, you know, I don't know. When I got my first coffee job, as soon as I was old enough and as soon as I could convince someone to hire me, it didn't stop from there. So it's always evolving. It's always changing. Even though I own Strange Matter and I have all these employees that, you know, we're constantly learning and training every day, I feel like I'm constantly learning every day too. And that's one of the things I love about coffee, is that I feel like I've never really stopped learning. It's never reached this point with me where I feel like I've mastered it, and I don't really feel like I'll ever reach that point, because there's so many different facets of the coffee industry that are just so detailed.
What are some of the things that you've learned recently?
Oh, man. I mean, coffee's seasonal. A lot of people don't even know that. It's a fruit that, you know, grows on a tree, and it grows at different times of the year in different regions. And just like all fruit and vegetables that grow seasonally in areas, it has a certain period of freshness. So you shouldn't be able to drink your favorite coffee year-round. It shouldn't exist year-round. And if it does, it's not fresh anymore, and it's not going to be at its peak deliciousness. So that was a really big eye-opener for me when I first started in coffee. I was like, wait, this blend changes, or if it doesn't change, like, I should question that, and when was this coffee roasted? All of these things are really interesting things that I first learned in coffee and kind of blew my mind and got me really into coffee.
One of the things that I see is very popular here, you have this lined up along the bar, is your pour-over workstation. What's the art of the pour-over? Where's the art there in that process?
It's a pretty intense process. They make it look really easy because they do many at a time and they do it really quickly, but it's a combination of many, many parts of a pretty intense recipe that involve your coffee to water ratio, which is really important. Water chemistry, what's in our water. We control our water very, very specifically for our pour-over bar and our espresso machine separately. In addition to that, you know, our grinders that we use, the particle size that those grinders are achieving, all of these things are super important in the process of making a really good cup of coffee consistently. And then they're also paying attention to their brewing temperature, their brew time, the devices that we choose to use, the Kalita Waves right now, and the consistency that they produce. All of those things are things that the people at the brew bar are thinking about as they're brewing each cup of coffee.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Karen Nader. She is the owner of Strange Matter. You sell coffee, too. What are you looking for when you're buying coffees, besides great-tasting coffee?
It's pretty simple. We try to not pay attention to brands or roasters or even the location of those roasters. We really want to highlight coffee. We want to highlight the work of the farmer, and, you know, we also want to highlight the work of the roaster along the way too. But when we look at roasters or when people send us samples, we try to set aside all of that information and just do blind tastings as a staff and go based on that. We taste coffee all the time, so I like to think that our palates are pretty diverse, and the staff has a pretty wide range of, you know, what they like. Some like super fruity coffee, some like really mild coffee. So when we do blind tastings, it enables us to kind of ignore roasters, where those roasters are from, all of those things that sometimes people focus on, and really just focus on the coffee itself and what's great about that coffee. And that's how we choose coffees, that's how we choose roasters. Right now, we're featuring coffee from three different roasters, and we have six different offerings. We have coffee from California that's roasted by 4Barrel, coffee from Chicago roasted by Intelligentsia, and Populous Coffee out of Bay City, Michigan, that's kind of a mainstay. They're always around. Try to work with, you know, a somewhat local or Michigan-based roaster to just have like that good relationship, and we try to build relationships with all of our roasters. I think it's really important, the relationships that involve, you know, that are around the coffee industry, working with roasters, the roasters' relationships with farmers. And then, you know, it's this big cycle where we highlight all of that in the cups that we're producing for our customers. And then we develop relationships with our customers.
How long have you been open now, and how's it going?
It's been a little over a year, and it's awesome. I never expected it to be so awesome. The reception from Lansing, East Lansing, you know, people drive from Okemos frequently, too. It's pretty amazing.
Voted number one, Lansing's People's Choice.
Thank you. That was really surprising. That was awesome. I think that happened before we were even 6 months old.
Karen Nader, she is the owner of Strange Matter. Glad to hear you're doing well and looking forward to the art of brewing coffee at the Broad Museum of Contemporary Art. It's happening September 25th. For Current State, this is Peter Wharf. Thanks, Kara.
Thank you.
Peter and Kara, thank you so much. Because after all, life is too short for a bad cup of coffee. Coming up on Current State, construction moving ahead of schedule at the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams at Michigan State University. U.S. Senator Gary Peters toured the project yesterday to see its development firsthand. Senator Peters is the ranking member of the Senate's Space, Science, and Competitiveness Subcommittee. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with Senator Peters about his observations at what I often think of as the Adam's rib. Plus, GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, they're a very hot topic these days. The restaurant chain Chipotle recently committed itself to using only non-GMO ingredients. But why are consumers shunning the fruits and vegetables with the GMO label? Dr. Kirk Heinze sits down to talk about the debate with Dr. Rebecca Grummet, professor in MSU's Department of Horticulture. That and more after the break. Hello, Sue Carter from the Michigan State University School of Journalism, sitting in for Mark Bayshore here on Current State. Pleasure to be with you again. Construction is steadily progressing on the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams, or the FRIB, at Michigan State University. Perhaps you've seen the huge crane down on Wilson Road. A new office tower that's rising at the site. Work continues on the underground chamber, which is going to house the accelerator at the heart of the project. Scientists one day, not that far off, will fire particles at near light speed to create isotopes that can be used in a variety of applications, including cancer treatment. Yesterday, Michigan Senator Gary Peters toured the FRIB chamber. Peters is the ranking member of the Senate Science, Space, and Competitiveness Subcommittee. Current State's Kevin Lavery went along on the tour, which began with a brief explanation of the project by FRIB Deputy Project Manager Paul Mantica.
What we're going to do is accelerate particles up to half the speed of light, smash those particles onto a target, and then produce rare isotopes that can be used to do basic discovery science. So the tunnel we're in here today is going to house all of the acceleration equipment that will produce those beams that travel at half the speed of light.
Let's show them where all the equipment's going to come down.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where's the entrance at?
The hatch.
Senator, how solid is the funding for this program? What else is competing at the federal level that's distracting from effort?
We have a lot of competing projects, and so it is a constant battle to make sure that the funding comes. The fact that it has such a huge potential to transform what we know about physics and discovering new isotopes that will be beneficial in so many levels gives us a very strong case to make sure that that funding continues. Not just to build it, to also make sure we continue to have funding available so that the students that are here and their projects continue to be funded going forward. So, you know, science funding is not something you can do 1 year and 2 years. These are long-term commitments. And particularly when you make a substantial investment as this, nearly $700 million going into this project, this shows a commitment from the scientific community as to the importance of this facility. And with that, I will certainly be very aggressive to make sure that we continue to get the funding, and will use my position as the ranking member on the science subcommittee to make sure that occurs.
But people in other states want their projects done too. So does your position in the committee, is that the deciding factor?
Well, it certainly helps to be on the right committee and to be the ranking member, but it really, what else helps is the science behind it. And the science behind this project couldn't be stronger, and the commitment that we have from the University of Michigan State's commitment is strong, and the fact that this project, we already have a substantial investment in the project, and it's ahead of schedule, so it's hard to argue against it.
What are you seeing today that you are learning for the first time that's interesting to you personally?
Well, it's just amazing as to how complex this is, and to see the amount of work that goes in. And actually, this structure, as complex as it is looking at it and all of the pipes and the wiring that goes in, it's actually not as complex as the actual machine and the accelerator that will come in, which is really the heart and soul of this whole project. So it's going to be very exciting to see that happen. And to me, it just highlights the incredible talent that we have in our state, the incredible talent that's here at Michigan State University, to be able to think about a project like this, to organize it, to get the funding, and then to create it is a testament to everybody in this great state of ours. We're going to see dividends from this project after it's all up and running in 2020 that could very well transform our country and our world, and we're going to see those dividends for many decades to come.
Professor Sue Carter here with you on Current State, in for the vacationing Mark Bayshore. The rise of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, over the last two decades has triggered persistent concerns for health and for the environment. The GMO debate has been part of an ongoing discussion on greening of the Great Lakes heard on WKAR's MSU Today. Dr. Kirk Heinze hosts the feature, which is also heard occasionally here on Current State. Today, Kirk talks with Dr. Rebecca Grummet of the MSU Department of Horticulture and the graduate program in plant breeding, genetics, and biotechnology. Dr. Heinze first asked Professor Grummet to define genetically modified organism.
Genetically engineered organisms are organisms into which a new gene has been introduced to confer a desired trait. So, for example, greater than 95% of all of the insulin that is used today for treatment of diabetes is produced in bacteria that have been engineered to include a gene for the production of insulin. And the advantage to this is that we now can produce insulin in vats of bacteria rather than having to extract it from the pancreas of pigs. When we're talking about crop plants, genes have been introduced to help control insects, diseases, weeds, and environmental stresses such as drought.
I haven't. It's true. A lot of people aren't aware of it, but we've been doing biotechnology, genetic engineering, GMOs for a long time in research and science, particularly in agriculture.
Well, actually, it depends on how you're going to define genetic engineering and genetic modification. So the newer technologies that involve the introduction of specific genes, that's been done for a short amount of time, and I'll come back to that. But the general concept of genetic modification, we've been doing that since the dawn of agriculture. And I think it's easiest to visualize this if you think about dog breeds. Think about a Cocker Spaniel or a large spotted Dalmatian. Now, neither of those dogs would exist as they are in nature. They're the result of human genetic modification. They're the result of breeding efforts by people over the eons. And similarly, if we think about crop plants, they also have undergone extensive genetic modification. First, they were domesticated from the wild, and then over time, they began to be selected for traits that we considered valuable, whether it be yield or flavor or good baking quality or disease or insect resistance. And so these modifications have been occurring over a long period of time. The difference with modern genetic engineering is that now the genes can come from other species, and so they can be used to introduce a trait such as insect resistance that would not be available by conventional breeding. But because the genes can come from other species, extensive regulatory systems and safety testing has been put in place to assure the safety of these products. Another thing that we can think about is that the extent of change that's occurring by these methods, the newer genetic engineering methods versus conventional breeding. So, for example, coming back to the dog case, if you were to cross a Cocker Spaniel with a Dalmatian, you could imagine that very many traits would be affected. But in contrast with genetic engineering, we're introducing typically somewhere between 1 and 5 new genes. And that is against a background of a typical plant which has 20,000 to 40,000 genes those genes are what is required to define that plant, whether we're talking about the leaves, the roots, the stems, the flowers, etc. So as a portion of genetic change, it's much smaller. That said, we still do undergo safety testing to be sure that the new genes that are introduced are indeed not detrimental.
And I think in terms of regulation and oversight, as you brought up the issue, we're talking about agencies that range from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, there is a lot of oversight and scrutiny of these technologies to ensure public safety.
That is true. Any product that is on the market today will have undergone safety testing and approvals from USDA, EPI, as well as the Food and Drug Administration. And so current foods on the market have gone through all of these testing. In addition, I think it's important to know that while we do not require labeling, and that may be a matter of political issue, and that's fine, people should know what the stand for labeling is, and that is that the current definition is that the product is equivalent to that would not of a conventional form. It does not have any significant changes. If there were to be significant changes, whether it be in nutritional content or any kind of allergen, the current law does require that those things would have to be labeled. The products on the market today are not labeled because they do not have those changes. Again, whether or not you agree politically, from a scientific and rule standpoint, that is the current situation.
And are there any environmental problems associated with using GMOs?
Well, first I'd like to say that there are environmental impacts associated with any kind of agriculture, whether you're cutting down forests for subsistence agriculture or plowing fields that causes soil structure to be disturbed or using insecticides or fungicides to control insects and weeds. To the extent that GM crops are part of the agricultural system, they contribute to the environmental impacts of agriculture. But there are not specific impacts that are unique to the use of GM crops. In fact, the use of GM crops has had significant environmental benefits. For example, during the past 15 years, the use of BT cotton has led to a 25% reduction of worldwide use of insecticides for that crop. Another example is the use of herbicide-resistant crops in the U.S. has made it easier for farmers to adopt no-till or reduced till practices, which can reduce soil disturbance and erosion. Following the adoption of GE soybean in the U.S., the number of soybean farmers using no-till doubled to 50%.
Rebecca, related to that, what about the claim by some anti-GMO groups and even some findings of scientific study about GMO crops fueling an explosion in glyphosate use? We might use the word Roundup, but glyphosate in general. Any truth to those claims?
That claim is true. Roundup-ready crops are engineered to be resistant to the herbicide glyphosate, and the use of these crops has fueled an enormous increase in the application of glyphosate. However, at the same time, there is a nearly perfect anti-parallel line in the use of all the other herbicides that were on the market. Farmers were already using herbicides to control weeds. They just switched the type that they were using. Now, in the case of glyphosate, this was actually an advantage to the environment, since among the herbicides available, glyphosate has much lower toxicity to other organisms. Note, though, that this advantage is unique to the case of glyphosate. Had those crops been engineered for resistance to a less benign herbicide, they would not confer this environmental advantage. Another problem that's arisen from the very widespread use of glyphosate has been the spread of Roundup-resistant weeds. Like antibiotic resistance or resistance of cockroaches to insects, overuse of a product can select for resistant individuals within the population, which then multiply and spread. The Roundup-resistant weeds must now be controlled with other herbicides that are less benign to the environment.
And I know that there's a major push nationally, but Michigan, but nationally as well, in training and education with producers in terms of pesticide, insecticide, and herbicide application, and using some of the GPS technology and things of that nature, a lot of producers have been able to reduce, put exactly what they need on their crops as opposed to using excess amounts of glyphosate, for example.
Yeah, there certainly has been a trend towards more precision agriculture and using a lot of advanced technologies, including GPS, to be able to identify exactly where the problem spots are and reduce overall use. It's not a benefit to a farmer either to apply excess chemicals, both for the not only environmental concerns, which farmers do care about, but also economic concerns and time spent on the machinery.
Another claim that some groups make, and it gets into the human health issue and the nutrition issue. I've read a lot on this particular issue. My producer, Russ White, knows how passionately I feel about the need to educate the public on what the science says. But from my reading, Rebecca, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is virtually no scientific evidence that there are any nutritional, deleterious nutritional effects to GMOs.
Yeah, and I think I'm best answering that by directly quoting the results of academic and scientific studies. And I'd like to say first off that every major scientific society worldwide, including dozens from Europe, have come to the same conclusion that GM foods on the market are as safe as their conventional counterparts. And I would like to directly cite the conclusions of major reports. In 2005, there was a report from the International Council for Science representing 111 National Academies of Science and 29 scientific unions. And in 2010, there was a report from the European Directorate General for Research. The 2010 report states, directly quoting, "The main conclusion to be drawn from the efforts of more than 130 research projects covering a period of more than 25 years of research and involving more than 500 independent research groups is that biotechnology, and in particular GMOs, are not more risky than conventional plant breeding." And I specifically chose to emphasize this report from European studies because the resistance there is even greater than here.
Why is it that so many people, particularly in Europe, but also in the United States, seem to be resistant to what science has to say about GMOs?
That's a really tough question to answer, and there are a lot of complicating factors. I think that we as scientists, I hope that the message that we can send is what we do know. In the same way that we have a consensus about climate change, we have a consensus about the safety of the current use of the technology. The other thing that those reports emphasize and I would share is that as we continue to develop technology, we need to continue to make tests and make tests that are appropriate to the level of risk that we're considering. I think the other thing that comes into play is that while the safety issues are often played up, I think there are many underlying social and economic factors that come into play with people's concerns. And at that point, we certainly get beyond my area of expertise, and I also think that people can have a range of opinions there. And so I think it's important to distinguish between whether your concern is for one of the social or political or economic aspects relative to the safety aspects, and that I hope that people can separate those concerns as they make decisions about these technologies.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with the Michigan State University Horticulture Professor Dr. Rebecca Grummet. He's the host of Greening of the Great Lakes, heard on WKAR's MSU Today. It's also an occasional feature here on Current State. Sue Carter with the MSU School of Journalism here for Vacationing Mark Bayshore on Current State. Pop-up Stories is our live storytelling event where people in the community tell personal stories in front of an audience. The theme of our first Pop-up Stories event was Hungry and Fed, and Karen Blackman told a story from her college years. Karen was raised in the Upper Peninsula in the 50s and 60s, and she remembers following the footage from the Civil Rights Movement on TV and being very moved by it.
And after my sophomore year of college, I went to Washington, D.C. I followed a boyfriend there and got a job at a place, I don't know if any of you ever heard of it, Hogate Seafood Restaurant. So Hogate Seafood Restaurant was sprawling, enormous seafood, iconic restaurant in Washington, D.C. on the southwest side. It served 3,000 meals a day. It had places for 600 people to sit. There was a huge staff, as you might imagine. There was a wait staff, and there was a kitchen staff. And they had career people who worked there on the wait staff, but I was hired because they were hiring up for the summer. So I got a job. I was very unfamiliar with urban life. They fed the staff in the basement between the two shifts. We worked the lunch shift and the supper shift, and they fed us at a large cafeteria in the basement with a cafeteria line and two dining rooms. It started out to be a very lonely summer for me. The older waitresses weren't very friendly to me. It was quite an urban journey for me to get to work. One young waitress was also hired for the summer, and she was quite friendly, but she didn't live far away, so she would go during the in-between the lunch and supper shift. She sometimes would go off back home. But a few times we hung out together, and one day she confided a secret in me. She told me, "I am passing for white." And I was, I didn't know anything about that. And she said that if she had told people that she was black, that she was actually a light-skinned black person, but if she told people that she would not be hired as a waitress. That was not allowed. So meanwhile, my friendships kind of grew with the people in the kitchen. The black people who worked in the kitchen tended to be younger and were very friendly to me when I came into the kitchen to get my food. They always made, you know, various individuals who I became friends with made sure I got my food for my customers, and they were very friendly, and we had more in common. We were younger, and they would kind of joke around with me. So one day I was in the cafeteria between the shifts, and I was talking with Jeannie from the kitchen, and she was ahead of me in this cafeteria line in the basement. We both had full trays of food. We were being served in the cafeteria line by this very large sort of red-haired, burly guy who would cook the food and serve it to the staff. And I am talking to Jeannie. We're in mid-conversation, and I have a tray full of food, and I follow her into the dining room where she's going to eat, the dining room on the right. And suddenly this man, this big fellow who served the food, is in that dining room. He picks me up with tray of food and all. He throws me out of the dining room into the central area where the cafeteria line was. I fall on the floor. The food goes absolutely everywhere. And I am so embarrassed. I'm just angry, humiliated. No one seems to help me. I don't remember anyone helping me. I don't remember if I ate or not, or who cleaned up the food. I have almost no memory of the incident beyond that, except that I suddenly got it. Like, the black people who were eating in the right dining room, the kitchen staff, were eating there not just because they knew and liked each other. And the white people from the wait staff were not just eating in the left-hand dining room because they knew and liked each other, but because it was segregated. And it had not really been clear to me until that moment. So that's almost the end of the story. I went home that night to this apartment I was staying at. I called my sister Jill, who was at that time a new teacher in the Washington, D.C. area. She was dating a fellow whose brother happened to be in the FBI. The FBI called me up and did some investigation, and very promptly, within the next few weeks, starting before I left and went back to University of Michigan, the federal government desegregated Hogate Seafood Restaurant. So I have many thoughts over the years about this incident, some truly chastising myself about why I was so dense. But I recently had a charitable thought, which was that I've been thinking, because I work at MSU now, which I didn't until I was somewhat older, how young people like those I meet at MSU with a different paradigm than their parents sometimes make, even by accident, a difference in the world just by having that worldview that doesn't assume the old one. And then at those times, I think maybe that was a good thing about my naive, clueless, yet good-willed self.
Karen Blackman, who shared her story at Current State's first pop-up stories. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, more than 13,000 children and caregivers are part of Michigan's foster care system. Yesterday, a forum called Raising the Voices of Caregivers from the Foster Care System discussed how to make life better for caregivers and the children living with them. Current State talks to Michelle Corey and also State Rep Jim Runstead. Plus, a new book from the MSU Press looks at the cookbooks and foodways of Americans in the 1860s. Food in the Civil War Era, the North, is officially out this week from MSU Press. Current State's Melissa Benmark will talk with the author, Helen Zoe Veit of the MSU History Department. I'm Sue Carter, filling in for Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.